morning on this, this gray day.
We had summer, now we have winter again. But here we are, we're all here. Good morning.
No, go ahead. My clerk put things on the wrong.
Oh. Good morning. Good morning.
Okay. Case number one. 113691, Beller versus Health and Hospital Corporation. It's Mr. Mayor. Good morning.
Mine wrong, please.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've only been here 25 years.
Do you see what happens when we start at 9 o'clock instead of 9:30? You think you're the ones that suffered. No!
I sit in three different places today.
And you're all going to be forced to sit here and watch him.
Do I have to get cards on the other side?
Yeah, you're there.
No, you're sitting here, right?
No? I'm not moving.
Okay.
Took me 19 years to get here. I'm not moving.
These are his cards.
So you got cards?
Here.
Thank you.
So this is like musical chairs. This is probably a first for the Seventh Circuit.
Mr. Mayor, if you still remember why you're here.
I do, Your Honor.
You're here for Beller versus Health and Hospital Corporation.
Yes. May I start?
Of course.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Jerry Mayer, and I represent the plaintiff's appellants, Joshua Beller and Joshua's mother, Melissa Welch, in this matter. The sole issue presented for review in this case is whether the definition of comes to the emergency department that was in effect on the date when all events giving rise to the cause took place, June 14, 2001, is the definition that should be applied to the facts in this case, or whether the definition that went into effect on November 10, 2003, more than 2 years after the events occurred, should be applied retroactively. The narrower question that the Court must decide in order to resolve this issue is whether the 2003 definition of comes to the emergency department represented a substantive change or was merely a clarification of the term comes to the emergency department.
Now, how do you believe the 2003 amendment is inconsistent with the earlier language?
Well, the earlier language said that if an individual is in a hospital-owned ambulance, that individual has come to that hospital's emergency department. The 2003 language in the definition said that an individual in a hospital-owned ambulance has not come to that hospital's emergency department if the ambulance is controlled under a community-wide emergency medical system. So they're polar opposites of one another when it comes to...
Isn't the amendment merely a clarification of what it means for an ambulance to be not just owned, but also operated by a hospital?
Well, Your Honor, I guess it might be useful. When EMTALA was passed in 1986 and the government gave the Department of Health and Human Services the power to implement, to interpret and implement, from that date in 1986 until 2003, the Department of Health and Human Services' interpretation of what it meant to come to a hospital emergency department was that included the individuals that were in a hospital-owned ambulance. In this case, Wishart Hospital owned the ambulance that Melissa Welch and Joshua Beller were in. And in 2001, it was crystal clear that the agency interpretation or definition of comes to the hospital emergency department included Joshua Beller and Melissa Welch.
Well, what's your position then? Once it's in the ambulance, it's come to the emergency department of the owner of the ambulance, right?
Yes, and that's mine, and that was the agency's position.
Well, unfortunately, we couldn't find anything where this happened before, where something happened in the ambulance. It seems to me your position to follow through with is that the emergency cesarean would have to be done by the EMT.
No, it would need to be done at Wishart Hospital, which is
trauma. They shouldn't have gone to another hospital. They had to go to Wishart, wherever. I don't know the geography here. How far is Wishart?
Well, Wishart was, according to the evidence in the record, was 1 to 2 minutes further away than Beech Grove. But also, Beech Grove did not do OB. So the time that was wasted by going to Beech Grove and then taking the patients out of the ambulance, doing an examination, putting them back in the ambulance, and then taking them to a hospital where the emergency cesarean section could be performed, wasted valuable time. And that was the very reason for EMTALA in the first place, was so that a hospital could not transfer a patient until, if that patient had an emergency medical condition, until they had done sufficient treatment to stabilize that emergency medical condition, if they had the ability to do it. And Wishart Hospital did. It's in the record. They're a trauma one center, and they have an emergency OB team in the hospital all the time. I'm sorry.
But does it make sense that hospitals whose ambulances are simply complying with community-wide protocols intended to transport people in emergency situations to the closest hospital that they should be subject to EMTALA?
Well, they're not now. But when EMTALA went into effect in 1986, the emergency medical systems were different. And emergency medical systems evolved over time. And the reason that the Department of Health and Human Services changed their interpretation of comes to the emergency department is that hospitals came to the department and they said they had concerns because they told the department our systems are evolving and sometimes it may be more appropriate under our community-wide emergency medical systems to take an individual to a hospital other than the hospital that owns the ambulance.
Tell me where I'm wrong, okay? Because to me, the 2003 amendment clarifies that where an ambulance is operated under a community-wide EMS protocol, which directs which hospital is sent to, that ambulance is only owned and operated by a hospital if the ambulance is directed to that hospital. Where am I wrong?
Well, under the 2001 regulation. When a patient, the reason that the DHHS made the rule what it was that they recognized that a hospital could divert patients due to financial concerns if the patient was in their ambulance, but not yet in their emergency department. And so that was the specific reason that they passed this law, or that they passed this regulation, so that hospitals couldn't transfer patients from their own ambulances to another hospital until they had stabilized the patient's emergency medical condition. As emergency medical systems evolved, then they published a proposed change to the regulation that allowed if a hospital-owned ambulance was being directed to another hospital under an emergency-wide system, it would be okay to do that. But they said, you know, we're proposing this change, and they solicited comments. And after they got the comments, then they changed the law effective November 10, 2003. And the reason it doesn't relate back is that in Bowen versus Georgetown Hospital, the United States Supreme Court held that an administrative agency may not promulgate retroactive rules unless Congress has expressly given the agency the power to do so. Now, this court has interpreted that Bowen restriction on retroactivity of rules only to rule modifications that make a substantive change in the regulation, but not to those that merely qualify the regulation. That's why the question that controls the outcome of this appeal is whether the 2003 modification of the definition comes to the emergency department represents a substantive change or is merely a clarification of the meaning.
Well, there's significant evidence that the agency certainly believed it to be a clarification.
Well,
and of course, we defer. We defer to that expressed intent unless the prior interpretation is patently inconsistent. Those are the words, the two words, patently inconsistent with the new one. And there's nothing patently inconsistent between the original language and the clarification.
Well,
that's our problem here.
Well, Judge, this court has said that this court's precedent has made it clear that a court defers, but it does not abdicate to an agency's characterization of a modification as a clarification. Rather, it conducts its own analysis and reaches its own conclusion. Now, there are two instances in the final rule where the department refers to the modification as a clarification, but there are also several instances in the final rule where it refers to the modifications as changes. I'll refer you to plaintiff's separate exhibit, B49, where in its summary section the DHH stated, in the May 9, 2002 proposed rule, we specifically solicited comments on all of these proposed changes. And in the next paragraph, it states as follows, and I quote, in the next several sections of the preamble of this final rule, we summarize the public comments received on the proposed EMTALA clarifications and present our responses to those comments, including further revisions that we are making in this final rule to the proposed regulation changes as a result of these comments. It also referred, the DHHS in its background section of the final order stated as follows, in a proposed rule published in the Federal Register on May 9, 2002, we solicited comments from hospitals, physicians, patients, and beneficiary groups on proposed changes to the EMTALA policies. In the summary section, the next section, they say, to help promote consistent application, and this may be exactly on your point, to help promote consistent application of the regulations concerning the special responsibilities of Medicare participating hospitals in emergency cases. In the May 9, 2002 proposed rule, we proposed changes to 489.24, and then they say to clarify. It's clear that they're not, I think that the only logical conclusion to come to, since they used the word changes and clarifications both, And by the way, in some places...
But they say changes to clarify. If ever there was a phrase, isn't that it?
Judge, they also use the phrase clarifying changes. But I guess even more important, and I see I'm getting into my rebuttal time, but I would like to go ahead with this if I could. The court still has to make its own analysis, even if the agency expressly says that it was a clarification rather than a change. According to this court, the strongest indication of a substantive change is inconsistent inconsistency with a previously stated position.
And that's what I wanted to get to, because the old and the new regulation, I don't see it. I don't see that they are inconsistent. The earlier rule didn't mention this situation and could be read to have the same meaning as that in the new regulation. It doesn't make sense to say that ambulances should have to take their patients to their own hospitals in emergency situations when those hospitals could be further away. So, I mean, I don't see it as a big inconsistency.
But
it's just filling in what was missing and giving guidance.
But Your Honor, the department has explained that they specifically said that hospital ambulances were considered, if you presented to a hospital ambulance, you were in that hospital's emergency department. And the reason they did that was so that hospitals couldn't transfer patients that had emergency medical conditions without treating them. For financial reasons.
I'm sorry, is every ambulance case considered an emergency? Seems to me that
The first case that comes to mind is Arrington v. Fong. I think that was a case where the district court actually applied actually said that the patient was in the hospital-owned ambulance, was in that hospital's emergency department, even though it wasn't on the hospital's property.
Well, I only mention it because it seems to me you don't have an ambulance unless there's an emergency.
Well, I that would be the logical conclusion. I think ambulances are called sometimes by people that maybe are overreacting to a situation, but that's what the DHHS was trying to get at. If you're in this ambulance, you're in an emergency. You've got an emergency medical condition, assumedly, and therefore you're in this hospital's emergency department. That's the way they interpret it from the inception of the statute in 1986 until the change on November 10, 2003, which was more than two years after the events that occurred in this case. Thank you, Your Honors. I see my time's up.
I'm going to give you, a minute or two for rebuttal because we asked a lot of questions, so don't worry.
Thank you, Judge.
Sure.
Okay. Mr. Babb, good morning.
May it please the Court, Counsel. This case asks whether an agency rule can be retroactively applied because it was meant to clarify an unsettled and confusing area of the law. This court should affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment in favor of the hospital because the department's clarifying 2003 definition or interpretation of the phrase comes to the emergency department is entitled to Chevron deference and should be applied to this case. Alternatively, assuming that the plaintiff is correct, and that the department meant for the 2001 definition to apply, thus requiring Wisher to ignore this community-wide EMS protocol, this court should still affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment because the department's interpretation would not be entitled to Chevron deference. It would be arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable in significantly disrupting the regional trauma and EMS system at issue here, which is not in accord with the Act's intent. Your Honor.
At the time of the original language in, I think, 2001, were ambulances being operated pursuant to community-wide EMS protocols which directed where they could go, or was that a later development?
Your Honor, the record is not clear on that. Mr. Mayor used the word evolving, which I think is accurate.
Okay.
I think what happened was is that as communities looked at better ways to provide emergent care, you had an act that was designed at its core to provide patients with the fastest, most appropriate care. And then what you had is you had this situation where most of the ambulances in a community were actually not hospital-owned. In fact, I believe in large part, it's not in the record, because of EMTALA, most of these ambulances are not hospital-owned anymore. Mm-hmm. They're operated by third-party vendors.
But is this the fire department or who?
In this, Your Honor, no. This is the hospital.
I'm talking about who normally operates ambulances. I hear them go by all the time. I don't know who's running.
Fire departments. I believe they also even have independent companies that contract with the hospitals that actually perform these services now. In this particular situation, Wishard had its own ambulance service, and I don't believe to this day that they do. But in any event, the point would be is that you can imagine the fog on an emergency situation, and here you are. And I don't disagree with Mr. Mayor that it may have only been 1 or 2 minutes farther away, but it was clearly farther away. Geographically, you're talking about the south side of Indianapolis. It's an emergency situation, a prolapsed cord. The only way you're going to stabilize this patient is to deliver the baby. You're probably not going to be able to do it, obviously, in the ambulance. So according to EMTALA, the way that they're claiming that the department would have wanted this to be applied, you have to drive all the way through the middle of downtown Indianapolis to go back up to Wishart, as opposed to going to the most appropriate closest hospital, which is what their direction was under their protocol. And so that's where I say, alternatively, Congress could not have meant for EMTALA to get in the way of care. In fact, one of the issues that is in this case is that there's really no... I understand that Bowen's ban on retroactive rulemaking. You have to have a congressional pronouncement that you can make retroactive rules if you're an agency that's enforced with interpreting a statute. And then the agency itself has to say, and by goodness, we intend for this to apply retroactively. There's an exception to that that says that for rules that, and regulations that clarify unsettled and confusing areas of the law. One of the issues in the brief is there's no evidence in this case of that, and I would disagree with that. There's five examples in this case of how, over time, this had evolved to create confusion. One is that there's two examples of testimonial evidence. One, Dr. McGough, who was the defendant's EMTALA expert, 25 years board-certified emergency physician, said that if you're going to apply EMTALA in this case to forced them to ignore this community-wide EMS protocol, it would have, quote, significantly disrupted regional trauma and EMS medical systems, which is understandable. Now, in his deposition, he was quoting the Bitterman text, which we have at tab one of our brief of appellee. Bitterman wrote a scholarly publication on how EMTALA is applied. Mr. McGough also said that applying EMTALA in this case would be a ludicrous interpretation, because you would be forcing this ambulance to go to a farther away facility, its facility, as opposed to the closest, most appropriate hospital. There's actually also in the rule itself, in the clarifying rule itself, I know we talked a lot about where the word change is in there. Well, of course it's a change. The text was physically changed, but the changes were meant to clarify. And in fact, if you look at the preamble, which is at appellate page B46, the department clarified that its 2003 set of clarifications was needed to ensure uniform and consistent application of policy underlying EMTALA's enforcement. And it was also needed, and this is important, to avoid any misunderstanding of EMTALA's requirements. It would be a misunderstanding to think that only a hospital-owned ambulance would have to drive farther away as opposed to trying to get that patient to the closest appropriate hospital. And then finally...
Who determines who picks the patient? When you call 911, who decides what ambulance is coming?
Your Honor, that's a good question. There are typically in Indiana, there's a county emergency 911, and it basically gets vectored based on where you are, and it might even be who picks up the actual call, whether it's a landline or a cell phone. I'm not really sure, but there are typically up to three emergency 911 systems in a county. It's not really an issue in this case, but I don't believe, for example, that Wishart was operating its own 911 service in terms of having the operator there. But I really think that if you look about this confusion, the Toretti case, and we cited that, that actually is not a case that talks about a retroactive application. But what Toretti does is a Third Circuit case. It actually looks at these same 2003 clarifying regulations, and it says that they were needed because of the confusion in the interpretation and application of EMTALA. They set up this regulatory reform task force, and they recommended clarifications to the statute. Now, we also provided the court with the Camoy article at tab 2 of the brief of appellee, and I think this is really the compelling point that it makes. First of all, it talks up front, and Mr. Mayor points this out in his brief, that the 2003 clarifying regulations attempt to clarify issues that have vexed hospitals, patients, regulators, and courts for the 18 years of the statute's history. And then it goes on and it says this. what was designed as a straightforward guarantee of emergency care has yielded a myriad of confusing regulations that in some cases have reduced access to care. It could not have been Congress's intent, in an effort to try to avoid patient dumping, in an effort to also clarify, and by the way, the Act itself is silent as to ambulances. So that's where the agency comes in and says, look, for the same reason that when somebody who's indigent shows up at the physical bricks and mortar of the hospital, you can't turn them away. You have to screen them for a medical emergency medical condition and then stabilize it before you transfer. For the same reason that you can't do it at the actual hospital, we're not also going to allow you to turn away indigent patients and dump them with your ambulances. Well-intended, consistent interpretation by the agency of the phrase comes to the emergency department because it's not defined. Over the years, it evolves where now we have these independent community protocols that are designed to actually speed up and provide better care. That the application of ambulances to avoid patient dumping wouldn't make any sense if you're actually trying to decrease the quality of care by saying that it still applies to ambulances, even if you're under a community-wide EMS protocol. Now, I can tell you that I looked, and I don't want to overstate, but I have, in this circuit, I have not found a single case where one of these regulations, and with the rule of law that we're discussing here, has not been retroactively applied. Every case has been retroactively applied because we've deferred to the agency's power to clarify. In the Pope case, retroactively applied. In the Treadway case, retroactively applied. In the Clay case, and this is really, I think, the best example. This was cited by the district court. Really, Mr. Mayer's position is the reason why it's patently inconsistent is because it says A, and then it says B, which is an exception to A. So because it's an exception to the previous rule, it's different. Well, I would say textually it is different. But here's what we said, and here's what the court said in Clay. This was the Federal Reserve Board and the Truth in Lending Act. That the board's general rule, and this was, by the way, this was when you go in and you purchase something and you're given credit, you're trying to tell the debtor, you're trying to give them a clear line of when they had their payments are due. Okay, so the general rule that applied back before the case, the general rule that applied at the case in hand in Clay, required a creditor to disclose a specific date, an actual date, on which the debtor's payment will begin. Its exception, the later promulgated clarifying exception, definitively states that a creditor may disclose the debtor's beginning payment date by referring to a specific event. So if you take the argument that's going on here, you, literally in June 1st, Your Honor, that's when your payments are due. Okay, that's what the rule was. The clarifying regulation said, you know what, we're not going to actually make you say June 1st. We'll say 30 days from an event. And so that's textually different. But in this case, in Clay, the court retroactively applied it because they said it's consistent with the Act's overall intent. First National Bank, retroactive application. And Time Warner Cable, which is at 66 F3rd, 867, again, retroactive application. And I think that's interesting because, again, I heard the word evolve. Here, I'll finish with this, Your Honor. And this is a quote from Time Warner. In our view, the various interpretations of the FCC are best viewed as presenting an evolving focus rather than conflicting pronouncements. And, Your Honor, I would contend that here the evolving focus was at some point in time when we had these EMS protocols and they were designed to provide faster, more appropriate care, that Congress would not have intended them to impose liability on the hospital in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, you used your time, but 2 minutes.
Treadway and the other cases that allowed retroactive application of regulations, in each case, the courts analyzed the regulations to determine whether it was a clarification or an actual change. And again, this court said that the strongest indication of a substantive change is if the new regulation is inconsistent with the old regulation. The new regulation, I think, obviously, was not the same as the old regulation. It did not state the law as it had always been. It changed the law. And it may be true. I want to follow that line of thinking for a moment. If that weren't true, when the judge applied the 2001 regulation to the facts in this case, and when she applied the 2003 regulation to the facts in this case, if the laws weren't different, then she would have reached the same conclusion in both cases. It wouldn't have mattered if the 2003 regulation restated the law as it is and has always been, she would have had to have reached the same conclusion, no matter which of those two laws she applied. They're clearly different on their face. And in this case, the ambulance did not take this patient to the closest appropriate hospital. The ambulance took the patients to a hospital that couldn't provide the treatment that the patients needed. They couldn't do an emergency cesarean section. Whereas the hospital that owned the ambulance could have. That's what they do. They're a trauma one center with an OB staff on duty 24 hours a day to do this very procedure.
Is the driver the decision maker on that?
In this case, the driver was the decision. There's record in the evidence. The district court found that it was a question of fact as to whether it was the driver, the EMT, on the ambulance who made the decision, or whether it was the doctor. But it's a question of fact. It wouldn't be right for summary judgment, you know, based on it maybe being the doctor. The EMT said, I made the decision. And I guess the other thing I would say that, it couldn't have been Congress's intent either when it passed EMTALA, for an ambulance to take a patient with an emergency medical condition to a hospital that couldn't treat that condition. That would have also been a ludicrous result, or that would have been the ludicrous result. And that's the result we have here.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to both.